Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Texas Department of Public Safety Officers Association and others versus Denton.
May it please the court, Mr. Guy Holman will present argument for petitioners. He can speak for 10 minutes.
Approximately 5 years ago, my client Jeff Hurd, who's a local CPA here in Austin, was retained by the co-defendant in the underlying case and the co-respondent or co-petitioner herein, the Department of Public Safety Officers Association. The DPSOI had retained my client to examine certain expenditures that had been made by the executive director of the Department of Public Safety Officers Association, Mr. Lane Denton. My client, after having met with the respondent and made certain findings and reported to the DPSOI, the respondent was thereafter terminated as the executive director of the DPSOI. That occurred approximately 4.5 years ago in January of 1990. On October 16, 1991, on the same day that the respondent was indicted by a Travis County grand jury for misappropriation of fiduciary property, he filed suit against the DPSOI, his former employer, former party that he had a contract with, and the law firms that had been representing the DPSOI. The party is no longer a party to this dispute. Excuse me. In April of 1992, my client was added as a party to the suit through the filing of plaintiff's second amended petition. In that petition, the theories being alleged were breach of contract, tortious interference with business relations, invasion of privacy, intentional infliction of emotional distress. The petition sought unspecified actual damages and $5 million in exemplary damages. On June 11, 1992, the deposition of the respondent was commenced. Many of the questions that were asked at that deposition were objected to based upon the Fifth Amendment. On June 15, 1992, 4 days later, a hearing was held before Judge Dibrell seeking to compel the underlying plaintiff and the respondent now to answer these questions or run the risk of having his case dismissed based on the decisions that have previously been handed down by this court, the Ginsburg decision, and also based upon the Henson case primarily that was decided, I believe, by the Court of Appeals in Eastland. Those cases simply saying, for brevity's sake, that the doctrine of fundamental fairness can require that a plaintiff, in essence, exercise an election of pursuing his civil claims or standing on his Fifth Amendment rights in the case of Henson, or the attorney-client privilege in the case, or the psychotherapist-patient privilege in the case of Ginsburg, must make an election between those two alternatives. The trial court ordered, at that motion to compel, that the plaintiff go forward and make that election. However, the trial court very specifically, in its order, stated that the plaintiff only had to answer questions concerning his claims against the defendants. We believe that that represents the trial court limiting the questions that had to be answered beyond what is normally permissible in discovery process. Those questions which may be reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. The deposition was resumed on June 16th and 17th, and once again, many questions were objected to based upon the Fifth Amendment privilege. In addition, documents weren't produced that had been subpoenaed at the deposition based again on the Fifth Amendment privilege.
Is there any reason why a privilege, the Fifth Amendment privilege, ought to be treated differently from the assertion, say, of an attorney-client privilege in Ginsburg because, of course, in a civil case, the finder of fact can draw a negative inference, which from the invocation of the Fifth Amendment privilege.
Well, certainly there are cases, I think, primarily from other jurisdictions outside of Texas, that do recognize there are distinctions between the attorney-client privilege and a constitutionally imposed privilege, such as the Fifth Amendment. I do not believe that this court has made that type of distinction in its previous decision in either Ginsburg, which of course wasn't a Fifth Amendment privilege case, or in Republic, the Republic case, which was an attorney-client privilege case. I think given the balancing test that the court needs to look at, as even espoused by Whalen, which of course we're going to hear more about in Mr. Yackel's argument, Mr. Brown's arguments, I believe that there certainly can be occasions where it's appropriate for at least those issues to be looked at, but I think on balance there is not a need to distinguish between the privileges.
Is there any reason why we shouldn't treat this whole issue as one under Transamerica and put it through that same lens?
I'm sorry, under the Transamerica?
As we would any death penalty.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Justice Phillips.
Transamerica. Is there any reason why that case doesn't apply and we should judge this decision by the trial judge the same as we would any death penalty sanction for any other reason?
I think, simple answer to the question, I don't think there's any reason that Transamerica doesn't apply. I think in the point even as made in the Whalen case was that the district court in that case was not precluded from using dismissal as a remedy to prevent unfairness to the defendant. While Whalen also said that could certainly be read to say that sanction in that case, dismissal as a sanction in that case was inappropriate, the Transamerican decision as I read it simply requires that a direct relationship between the sanction imposed and the offensive conduct must be shown. And I believe that that was shown here. In addition, it states that the sanction must not be excessive in light of the conduct that was involved. And I believe that Transamerican can apply and put the
excessive amount. Why wasn't this excessive?
Why wasn't
this excessive?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why wasn't this excessive?
I think you have to look at whether or not it was excessive in light of the issues that were involved at the trial court level. We were faced with defending claims, for instance, for tortious interference with contractual relations. Questions that were asked and that are cited on page 25 of our application for writ of error are what contracts were interfered with. And when the Fifth Amendment is pled there, it certainly makes it difficult for the defendant to be able to prepare his case for trial.
How would he have been harmed by an abatement of the civil proceedings after the conclusion of the criminal trial?
In my client's case, Your Honor, he's a professional. Every year he has to apply to the State Board of Public Accounts to have his license renewed every year. Every year he has to disclose litigation he's involved with. My client maintains insurance. Every year he applies for that, he's got to list litigation. Every year these things remain on that record, and they have now for going on 3 years. I believe that penalizes my client. Unlike the court, the Fifth Circuit, in the Whalen decision, they analyzed, using the balancing test, how would CBS be penalized in that case? How would they be harmed in that case? My clients are not CBS, or CBS. And I think under these circumstances, I don't believe the penalty was excessive.
Why couldn't the court have said as to those causes of action that the plaintiff has asserted for which he has answered no questions, he would not be permitted at the time of trial to produce evidence on those issues?
I think the court could have done that. I'm not sure that there was a whole lot of law out there suggesting that that's what the court should do, but it wouldn't be inappropriate I don't think the court, it wouldn't have been inappropriate to not to fashion and carve out that type of a remedy. I think some of the questions that were asked, practically speaking, there were many, many questions asked, and some were answered and some were not. There were probably more that were answered than weren't. I think it would be difficult, though, for a trial to possibly say, well, does this question, does it go more to the tortious interference with contract claim? Does it go more to the invasion of privacy claim? Practically speaking, I think it would be difficult.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Kim Brown will present arguments for respondents.
May it please the court, my co-counsel, Susan Dasher, the principal author of our reply brief, could not be present today. Assisting me today is Melanie Karstarkman, an associate attorney with my firm. This is a case of first impression for this court with respect to the specific privilege involved. The court is today called upon to uphold the right of a plaintiff to invoke his constitutional privilege against self-incrimination while preserving his right, his due process right, to pursue the civil action after the risk of criminal prosecution may have passed. We assert that the interest protected by the evidentiary privileges that are involved in Ginsburg and Republic Insurance do not approach the importance of the interest involved in this case and what was involved in the Whalen case, which we'll get to later. For that reason, the Republic Insurance case, the test there may not go far enough to protect the rights of a litigant who's faced with the self-incrimination privilege and not some of the other evidentiary privileges that this court has previously considered. I believe that the only prior reported case that involved, in Texas, that involves a self-incrimination privilege is the Henson case.
From that Bean.
Excuse me?
From that Ray Bean.
Your Honor, I think the circumstances were a little bit different. This court approved Henson in Ginsburg. I'm not sure that the circumstances in Ray Bean were comparable.
What, did you say the only prior approval by this court, or did you say by any reported?
Reported in the circuits in Texas. This court did approve and quote Henson then in Ginsburg, even though the interest involved in Ginsburg was just the evidentiary privilege of the psychotherapist patient privilege. In Henson, the Eastlands court found that the plaintiff may be forced to elect whether to claim his privilege or abandon his claim. And we think that election, forcing Denton to that election, as in Henson, would, in light of the serious interest presented by his privilege against self-incrimination, that it would be harsh, simplistic, inappropriate under Transamerican Gas.
What's the status of this case right now? Is Denton's criminal investigation still pending?
Your Honor, the case on the indictment that's been entered is on the trial court's docket. It's been scheduled for trial later than today. It's scheduled for trial. At the time that Denton was seeking an abatement of the civil suit, there was evidence presented by Denton that showed that there's yet another ongoing criminal investigation for matters that are broader in scope than the specific indictment that has been entered. And that's in the record and cited in the Austin Court's opinion.
And that's still ongoing?
Your Honor, the last information we had was at the trial court setting we presented an affidavit from someone at the Department of Public Safety that showed that at that time it was still ongoing. We don't know necessarily the nature of it or what the circumstances involved are. All we heard at that point is that there's another investigation broader than the indictment that was brought.
So how long is the length of time that the case should be abated a factor to be considered? Surely the plaintiff doesn't have the right to drag it out until every investigation he may be afraid of has been dropped.
I think that's correct. The time frame would have to be considered with respect to the specific statutes of limitations, and we'd have to determine what those are. The Whaling test, for instance, which I'm going to go into, did not say that there was an open-ended right of the criminal defendant, the civil plaintiff, to not testify. It simply said you abate for the appropriate time.
Mr. Brown, the civil court has not compelled Mr. Denton to testify in this case in any manner, has he?
Yes, sir. He was ordered under a motion to compel to testify on all matters that that were before the court in the pleadings at that time.
And he has refused to testify?
That's correct. But he refused to testify not only about those matters that were in the pleadings, but also about some of these other matters that we were suspected might be involved in the other investigation.
But he personally has not been sanctioned for failing to provide that testimony, has he?
Only in the sense of having his lawsuit dismissed.
Now, if the trial court considers that, if the trial court takes into consideration that this gentleman is asserting his constitutional right against testifying to matters that might incriminate, the court says, okay, that's fair enough. You've got that right, you can do so. But I don't see how you can prove your case if you're not going to allow discovery into those areas. Therefore, I see no reason to proceed with the civil action. Could that not be a reasonable basis for the trial court to proceed as opposed to sanction him for failing to testify, but simply to come to the conclusion that without participation in the discovery, there's nothing the plaintiff has left to produce at trial that they could facilitate the civil action so the civil action should be dismissed rather than just sitting here without any proof?
He cannot prove his civil case at this time as long as he remains under the threat that information that he gives could be used in a criminal prosecution against him.
Through any source? He can't prove his case by other witnesses?
He has other ways of putting on evidence, but that's a complete reversal of the Republic insurance test, which said that the information sought by the opposing party from that counsel, from that party, couldn't be obtained from another source. He has the ability, although he's not done so, he asked the court to abate all of the discovery, including his offensive discovery of continuing to take depositions. The record shows that he had two motions for protective order and one motion to abate, and he asked that all of the discovery be stopped, that he not have an unfair advantage. It would be unfair for him to be able to continue to take the opposing party's depositions while he had pulled down the shield of the Fifth Amendment. He asked for the whole thing to be put on hold, and he put on evidence then that showed his specific harm of the ongoing investigation and so forth. In the question that was asked earlier about Mr. Hurd didn't put on any of that evidence. There's nothing in the record. That's speculation about he's a professional, he has risk for insurance purposes, potential liability.
Has Texas law anticipated this particular problem by having a cause of action for malicious prosecution and the statute of limitations on that not running until the investigation's been dropped or it's otherwise been cleared to Mr. Denton's satisfaction? Couldn't a lot of this, if not all of this, claim against this department and the auditor all be brought as part of a malicious prosecution claim at the other end, assuming that the investigation is dropped or the trial results in acquittal?
The standard is very different for proving malicious prosecution. In this case, the prosecution is being handled through the Public Integrity Unit of the District Attorney's Office. They stated in the newspaper, and this is part of the evidence that we presented at the hearing, that they were looking at other things like lobbying activities and so forth, which would not involve these parties. So I'm not sure that his remedies would be effective in that at all.
Is it fair to say that the only two options available to the district court were abatement of the entire case for an unspecified period of time or dismissal?
I don't think that would be exactly correct because we weren't asking for an unspecified time. We were asking for a specified time, which was pegged to the time of the potential criminal prosecution and the indictment that was underway then. But in answer to your question, the Whalen case that we're urging did not say that those are the only two options. The abatement option is one of the options, and it leaves the discretion with the trial court about finding how much of an abatement, whether the whole case, whether certain parts of discovery. It does leave, and this is pointed out in the appellant's brief, that Whalen leaves room for the trial court still to consider the specific circumstances of the case.
But if you were back before the trial court, you would still be urging abatement and still be claiming the Fifth Amendment privilege.
That's correct.
As of today.
As of today.
2 years later.
And that's correct. You have indicated that under Whalen abatement need not be perpetual, that it is for a reasonable time, since this has been going on now for a fairly considerable period of time. Do you have any guidance to us as to what a reasonable time is, other than strictly linked attaching it or to what happens in a criminal prosecution?
Justice Doggett, in the Whalen case, Mr. Whalen was never indicted. When an attorney from Houston named Tom Phillips argued on behalf of Columbia Broadcasting System against the abatement, they were looking at a statute of limitations period for, and they had dates pegged as to when Mr. Whalen had sold his business, for instance. So the wrongs that he was accused of couldn't have happened after that date. We're a post-indictment case. It is indefinite in the sense that the calendar of the criminal courts is completely outside of this proceeding. We don't mean it to be indefinite, open-ended, perpetual. It's pegged to when the criminal case, when it's tried. And as far as the other possible investigation going on, I think we have to prove to the trial court when those dates, we have to determine from the information we can obtain from other sources what acts they're talking about. And I think we can get that information if we had to without getting into the investigative privilege to simply say what types of actions or what dates are you looking at. That information is available. So it's indefinite in the sense that I don't know the date, but it's definite in that it's pegged to a certain event happening, and that's the criminal trial passing and the statute of limitations on the unindicted offenses.
Do I understand you to say that you actually do not know as you stand here before us the date of the trial from the indicted homicide?
The case has been set dozens of times on the docket. The way the dockets work in that particular court is they come up for dockets on pretrial hearings, and they have hundreds of cases that are set on the same dockets. And my understanding is they have preference for jail cases. And there are a whole lot of factors that it is not, there is now a trial setting within the next 30 days, I believe. I'm not involved in that case, but I believe there is a trial setting within the next 30 days. But I can't represent to you that that's the definite trial date.
And as far as you know, Mr. Denton has not been making any moves to postpone or continue his trial?
Your Honor, I'm not his counsel in that case, and I'm not involved in that case at all. I'm not aware of anything in the record, and I can't make that representation to the court.
Well, if the trial judge says, I'm going to abate this for 2 years, then it's going no matter what. And if you don't answer the questions, it's still part of the case, I'll dismiss it. That's something that even an appellate court might have to review as to abuse of discretion.
Your Honor, I think that would be arbitrary. I mean, it might be welcome relief to us at this point because 2 years might seem more than adequate, but picking a time we don't think would be appropriate. It's pegging it to a specific incident, and that is resolution of the criminal
case.
Some
of these criminal statutes and limitations are pretty long, aren't they? And you're asking for all discovery to just stop, and memories to get stale, and witnesses to die.
Mr. Denton has been indicted on the last day of the limitations period for the indictment lists the dates of financial transactions, and he was indicted on the third year anniversary of some of those transactions. These transactions for which he's been indicted are breach of fiduciary duty. They have a 3-year statute of limitations. He was indicted on the third year anniversary of some of those.
Is there any reason why all the other discovery couldn't go forward?
I think
that violating his Fifth Amendment
within the framework of a fairness analysis, I mean, it might seem that it's judicially economical to go ahead and keep getting other people's depositions, but I'm afraid that the defendants in the lawsuit are going to say that's inherently unfair, and we've not urged that on the court. In fact, we've urged the opposite. We've urged the fairness approach, saying if we can't give discovery, then we're not going to ask for discovery.
Well, in terms of the concern about delay from the standpoint of fading memories and lost documents and that sort of thing, why would it make sense to proceed with all the other discovery that is unaffected by his claim of the Fifth Amendment privilege?
I believe that an order like that would be consistent with the Whalen holding, because the Whalen holding says to the trial court, consider the circumstances and enter an appropriate abatement.
And the discovery which would be abated under that sort of approach would be his deposition and what else?
You mean, for instance, if the defendants wanted to go take depositions of third-party witnesses who may be getting old or moving out of state or that kind of thing?
That wouldn't be protected by the Fifth, Mr. Denton's Fifth Amendment privilege.
Correct, and we didn't ask the court not to do that. We simply said, we'll... The court, I mean, to backtrack a little bit, the court had entered a discovery order that laid out a bunch of depositions of the defendants and Mr. Denton. And we said, if we can't give the answers to ours, we think that we shouldn't be able to take yours under that discovery order. We didn't ask the third-party witnesses, and that's not a problem with us. Now, what we did say is that as a matter of judicial economy, that a whole lot of that discovery information is going to come out in Mr. Denton's criminal trial, we believe, because the district attorney is over there with a team of folks developing those cases, and it'll be done for free for these folks. It'll be a matter of public record.
So as far as the Constitution, preservation of your client's constitutional right, all you want frozen is his deposition?
That's correct. We don't need... There's a fairness problem about us being able to go out and take third-party witnesses' testimony if we're not giving our own deposition. There's no question that Republic Insurance is strong on the fairness test and says that's the pressing forward with your case concept, that you're seeking affirmative relief. And it's not fair for you to be able to go out and draw in matters to support your case if you're not willing to give your own testimony. So we're not opposed to that, but I'm not sure it would fit in under a fairness analysis to let us keep doing other discovery while refusing to give our own deposition. In looking at the Republic test, the Austin Court of Appeals found that Mr. Denton satisfied the first prong of the Republic test about seeking affirmative relief. Denton first sought a protective order seeking a stay of discovery. He second petitioned the trial court to abate all proceedings in the lawsuit until his criminal case was resolved. Third, he sought over the objections of the appellant a continuance in the trial setting. He lost that motion. Fourth, he undertook no discovery until he was ordered to do so under the discovery order. And fifth, he non-suited all of his causes of action in his case that were not yet time-barred, because that way people like Mr. Hurd didn't have to stay at risk of those things if there was no limitations problem on them. He has since had to rebring those on my hand.
What's the status of that?
Nothing.
Pending in the district court.
That's correct. It would be very difficult to characterize Denton's behavior as wielding a sword in the offensive use of the privilege. He was backtracking as quick as possible. Indeed, we would say that the appellant's points of error rely on the concept that simply having a petition on file is the seeking of affirmative relief sufficient to force Mr. Denton to an election. And we think that that is a concept that should not be the law of Texas. It's not under Republic, because Republic embodies a fairness doctrine overall, and Whaling is more specific when it's self-incrimination risk involved.
Why shouldn't, what is the policy against forcing Mr. Denton to make an election when he files his lawsuit? What is the policy against him making the election to either adhere to a privilege or to file his lawsuit?
Justice Enoch, in the Republic Insurance holding, the court said in introducing the three-prong test there, that privileges represent society's desire to protect certain relationships, and an offensive use waiver of a privilege should not be lightly found. Quoting Wigmore on evidence, your opinion said, one of the principles behind privileges is that the harm to the relationship protected by the privilege is greater than the benefit gained through complete disclosure. In having to make the election that you're talking about, he's having to choose between his civil lawsuit or his self-incrimination privilege. It's an absolute choice. And we're saying that that violates a due process right and his right of access to the courts by having to choose at any particular point in time. Because what we're talking about here is the Henson analysis, and I think that's really the question that you're asking, is why isn't Henson accurate? It's because it picks a particular point in time and says, as of this time, you've got to elect between one or the other. And we're saying that with the analysis that we're urging on the court, which is to include in the fairness analysis a balancing of the litigant's right, that that you don't have to select at a particular time because the abatement lets you wait until everybody can have their rights in court and everyone can have a resolution by the court.
If we were to reverse what the trial court did, would the trial court abuse its discretion in saying it's not fair to delay this case any further? I'm putting it to trial without any discovery by you, since you didn't provide discovery to them, and force you to go to trial at the time of the actual and possible indictments are pending, so that you would take the Fifth repeatedly.
Well, I think there's a problem with that question, Justice Phillips, because it would require the defendants to go to trial without having been able to do discovery. And when they lose, they're going to come back and say, gee, if we'd only known what Mr. Denton's answers were going to be, we might have settled with him. We might not have gone to trial or something. I think there's a problem.
Maybe that's an appellate point. And
the other thing...
I guess my thing is the docket is still with... Even if we reversed, if we were to find that some form of the Whaling Doctrine should apply in Texas, would the trial judge still have control over this docket as a... in terms of a trial as opposed to just deciding what date postponement is appropriate until?
I think that we would find a problem in compelling trial without the discovery in the same way that we would find it a violation of his rights to compel the discovery or make the election to dismiss. It's just another way of saying he has to dismiss, I think. The Whaling opinion has room, and that analysis says it's up to the trial court to find what's fair to the litigants, but they have to weigh the respective interests, weigh the interest of the defendant to get the trial over with versus weighing the interest of the plaintiff in postponing it until it can testify freely.
There can be some inconvenience to you for asserting the privilege.
There's a tremendous inconvenience to all of the litigants and expense for a delay.
It seems to me, I hear you arguing, that it has to be a delay of the civil trial until all possibility of criminal prosecution is precluded.
Well,
surely Whaling is not that much of a stake there.
In the sense of could the court find abuse by the criminal defendant installing his trial and so forth? I think that the trial court in the civil action does not lose control of his docket, does not lose discretion, and has some room in what they order as far as the relief.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Earl Nichols, will present petitioner's rebuttal. He will speak for 10 minutes.
Initially, I would like to answer a question Justice Gonzalez posed, and that involved the current status of the criminal case, because I have followed the criminal case very carefully since Judge Dibble's rulings 2 years ago. The case is currently set for jury trial on October 24, 1994. There has already been one legislative continuance granted at Mr. Denton's behest, so I'm a little bit sensitive to the idea that all of the equities in this case are flowing the other way. There has been no action on his part to attempt to get the criminal matter resolved. And I think that goes directly into the situation of how long, if a modified Whaling test were to be applied, how long do civil defendants have to wait to exercise their rights of access to the courts in order to do away with pending litigation against them. I personally have little doubt that if, for some reason, the case were not reached in October and were to be postponed to within 30 days of the next legislative session, yet another legislative continuance would be sought and granted, and we would be down the line into next summer before the criminal case was ever taken up.
And the harm to defendants is having to report this to a carrier, or an insurance carrier every year?
Well, what happens here, and I guess we have to look at the facts and circumstances of each case. For instance, in the Whaling case, CBS probably didn't face the same problems with an outstanding lawsuit against them over a long period of time as perhaps individual defendants who don't have much money would. I think the court can take notice of the fact that because I presume that each of the justices, like myself, has had to borrow money at one time or another, that on the face of virtually every loan application, there is a block for pending litigation. Here, that pending litigation block would have to be filled out by saying at least $5 million potential contingent liability, because that's the amount that's prayed for of punitive damages, and then we still have the undetermined amount of actual damages.
Are the defendants, complainants, and witnesses in the criminal prosecution?
Some will probably be, because the criminal indictment is misappropriation of fiduciary property, i.e. the taking of money that belonged to the Department of Public Safety Officers Association at the time while Mr. Denton was its executive director. Therefore, some of these defendants who were held offices at the time, such as perhaps Charlie Adams, the former employee, Ms. Becknell, now Mrs. Hope, and perhaps Mr. Moore would be called upon, I think, to be witnesses in that case. Further, the previous defendant, Frank Holland, that was non-suited on the, I believe it was the Fifth Amended original petition, would likely be a defendant of the names of the court, I mean a witness of the names the courts have seen. Mr. Hurd, who performed at the request of the Department of Public Safety Officers Association an audit of the books and records when the association suspected that there was wrongdoing on Mr. Denton's part, I think would clearly be a witness in that criminal case also. I would revert because
you said, just a moment ago, I guess we have to look at the facts and circumstances of each case. That's all Whaling really says, isn't it?
That's what Whaling says, Justice Hecht, and I think that I don't find Whaling that inconsistent with this court's recent opinion in Republic Insurance, because I believe that Republic Insurance, in a way, sets forth its own balancing test, and in response to a question that the Chief Justice asked my co-counsel about the application of Transamerican, I don't believe this to be a Transamerican case. I believe this to be a Republic Insurance case because I think there is a difference between a discovery sanction case and a remedy case. And the footnote in Whaling even recognizes this. A sanction case to me is where, for whatever reason, a party refuses to make discovery and violates the rules that we have, and I know the appellate courts have been backlogged with discovery cases now for 5 to 6 years, on whether you timely made discovery, whether the lawyers are being too tough on one another. I would submit to you that regardless of what our discovery rules were in the state of Texas or what they are in the future, this fact situation would still be presented because it's a privilege case.
The Court of Appeals used the identical case you're talking about. You want to rely on Republic, and how would you come out different in Republic other than a different result on the balancing
case? I think that the Court of Appeals didn't like Republic and didn't like the Republic decision.
Well, it analyzed each factor
and went around trying to ride around it. The Court of Appeals found that the first prong of Republic was not met because you did not have a request for affirmative relief if you had been requesting affirmative relief but later said, okay, King's X will abate now. Whereas in what I would call the second Transamerican case, the Flores, Transamerican versus Flores case, that this court had before it after Republic Insurance, the court found that the filing of a counterclaim was sufficient to show that that party was asking for affirmative relief. So the Court of Appeals on prong one said, yeah, a tort action might, in the first instance, be a request for affirmative relief, but it's not a request anymore if you move to abate it. Secondly, on the second prong, the court specifically found that many or some of the questions that were asked were outcome determinative, but ruled that since all of the questions where answers were refused were not outcome determinative, that the second prong wasn't met, which gives the plaintiff an opportunity to manipulate his deposition by refusing to answer questions that are not outcome determinative. And then you get to the third point, which the Court of Appeals rejected, by saying that all of the questions asked were not capable of, the answers were not capable of ascertainment from another source, but admitted that some of the questions were, and then reached the conclusion that because most of the evidence might be obtained from another source without any kind of recognition of the how crucial certain points of evidence are, and I submit to this court that I don't find anything in Republic Insurance that says that you weigh what was refused and not what was refused.
Shouldn't the constitutional privilege be weighed differently than the attorney-client privilege? And is it entitled the same weight or less weight or more weight than the attorney-client privilege non-constitutionally based?
I think the test in Republic is fair to all concerned because virtually every case that has looked at the Fifth Amendment privilege has not gone so far as to say there is an absolute bar to the proceeding with any civil action in the event of the raising of a Fifth Amendment claim. The courts have said that under instances, certain instances, you look at it, Whaling, they called it a balancing test. The earlier cases was the sword versus shield argument. But in each instance, every court that has examined the Fifth Amendment privilege has not held that it absolutely calls things off in a civil case.
Well, if the trial judge in this case, for example, had said, we're going to proceed to trial in this case, and Mr. Denton, as long as you want to invoke your Fifth Amendment privilege, that's fine, but you also can't testify on any matters in the civil proceeding upon which you've invoked the Fifth Amendment, and you proceed to take the depositions of all of their witnesses and have a jury trial, along with an instruction to the jury that they can draw a negative inference from his failure to testify. How does that? How would that outcome hurt you?
One, because without taking Mr. Denton's deposition, we don't know the names of all of the witnesses from which we could peripherally prove up our case. If the court examines the 129 questions that Mr. Denton refused to answer in the first round of depositions, and then the 70 he refused to answer after Judge Diverill conducted the first hearing, you find that many of the questions to which answers were denied were the very questions that would lead to other discoverable evidence involving people who were in fact not parties to any criminal indictment.
Did Judge Diverill attempt to look at those 70 and make any determination on whether those could be narrowed?
What Judge Diverill did, Your Honor, and I don't think that, and I think the Court of Appeals misstated what Judge Diverill did. What Judge Diverill did was when the first motion to compel was filed, he conducted a hearing. He examined the first deposition. It was before him at that hearing. He ordered the deposition to be reconvened and specifically ordered Mr. Denton to answer those questions that went to the allegations against the defendants. The examples of those questions are found in the record, but some of them he has accused some of my individual clients of slandering him in statements that they made to board members of the association and to investigative officers of Travis County. But yet when we came back and asked those questions out of the proceeding, out of the pleadings, he refused to state what defendants had made statements and what those statements were. I would submit to you that that has nothing to do with his criminal case. There are other instances of that. When we came back before Judge Diverill, again, Judge Dibrell, on his own motion, continued the case, which had been set for the following Monday. I think this final hearing was on like a Thursday, in order to give him an opportunity to study the depositions that were now back before him, which were those depositions taken the 16th, 17th of June after the first hearing. He had those before him for 2 weeks and read them. And that's what he recited and ruled that because of the refusal to answer those questions, he was imposing the sanction of dismissing the pleading. Pardon me, I don't believe it was a sanction. He was finding that he did not answer the specific questions about the case at hand.
If the only other fact that were different in this case were that Mr. Denton thought he could get his criminal problems resolved within 3 months, would it have been an abuse of discretion for the trial judge to dismiss the case?
It possibly could have, Justice Heck. I would merely say, in closing to that remark, though, that I believe that we should have one test, and the test is Republic. And therefore, if Judge Dibrell looked at those factors and those were before him, Republic provides a balancing test because if the factors are met, I think the balance is weighed. I don't know how we get into what's 3 months and what's 3 years.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in all of the cases for today's submission docket. The foregoing causes are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.